jury's like, oh, snap, a twist. Like, they love twists. Any great trial has a twist.
I suggest that we give him 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in Smallworth.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
Like this, Mr. Court.
Address the judge as your honor.
Well, it was like this, my honor.
Your honor, not my honor.
Why? Don't you like him?
You're meant to come down here and defend me against these characters, and the only one I've got on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 322. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. You know, one of the things that I love the most about my recording studio, which is located in my basement, is that it is served by electricity. So, apropos of nothing, how are you doing?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a privilege nowadays. That's something that not everybody in the good old US of A could say. Doing okay. Thanks for just instantly triggering me because found out today we may be speaking to, you know, of the pool of people who could be listening to us. It's gone down by about 2 million because something like 2 million Californians might just have no power for 5 days. Can you just, Andrew,
you precious little snowflake,
can you imagine not having power for 5 days?
No, I when the power goes off for about 5 minutes, I start twitching.
Yeah, this is coming from somebody. I grew up in the sticks. I grew up so like the power would go out because somebody hit a power line somewhere with their car, and we'd call PG&E, and they'd be like, "Oh, there's people where you are," and we'd be like, "Yeah, there's a couple people here. Like, can you turn the power on?" They're like, "All right, well." We'll send a Sherpa, a man and a donkey out there to find where you are and turn the power back on. And so I'm no stranger to power outages. And I think the longest one that we ever had was, it was like just shy of 2 days.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, you can't go back into civilized society after you haven't had power for 32 hours. Like you lose all ability to socialize. You're not even a human anymore. You're more beast than man. You can't live without power for 5 days. Now, let me tell you this. The reason that 2 million Californians, including my parents, including, by the way, you know, my dad's pretty sick. So there are a lot of sick elderly people who all of a sudden are going to have their power shut off. My wife's parents, no power for 5 days. Why, you might ask? Did a meteor hit a power plant? Are we under attack? Is it the Russians? What is it? No, it's a precaution because it's really windy, so they don't want any power lines to start a fire. So it's just in case for 5 days. Yep. How? Okay, so I had to bring this onto the show because
that's okay.
How?
That's okay.
My legal question for you, listener Thomas S. How in the world is this legal? This is a human rights violation. How many people are going to die because of this? I'm not even joking. Like, how many, you know, like 5 days of business losses? This has got to be a massive hit to the economy of California. This is not the country either. It's the Bay Area. It's Silicon Valley. It's San Jose. It's all those areas. It's insane. What is happening?
So here's the basis. The California Public Utilities Code, Section 451, requires that public utilities shall furnish and maintain adequate, reasonable service as necessary to promote the safety, health, comfort, and convenience of its patrons, employees, and the public. That provision, in broad language, has been interpreted through rulemaking by the California Public Utilities Code to provide for what the California Public Utilities Commission's calls de-energization events, and what PG&E calls public safety power shutoff events. And it is, as you described, right? It is that if the belief is that the combination of extrinsic weather factors would create potentially unsafe conditions that would cause wildfires that could rage.
I'm just going to jump in for five quick seconds. The combination of weather factors plus they haven't kept their clown horning infrastructure up to date, so everything's like old and crappy, and that's the reason why it might cause a fire. It's not, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's their fault. No argument that it is not their fault. The question is, when you have an entity that is too big to fail, like PG&E, which, by the way, is in bankruptcy, right? It is undergoing a Chapter 11 reorganization. because of the
fire,
$8.5 billion in liabilities that it has from starting the last wildfire. So there really is. I mean, obviously, I'm sympathetic, and it, you know, it should not be an option to turn off power for 5 days. From PG&E's perspective, they're like, look, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we don't shut off the power and we start another wildfire like the 2017 wildfires, then, you know, that's going to cause untold billions of dollars in damages, loss of life, loss of property. And
you know, injuries. It might be safer for them to just not serve power to anybody at any time. Why don't they just? Well, it sounds like that'd be the safest option. You know, I'll help you. Just don't be a power company if you can't serve power to people in a reasonable way. How about that?
Get right on
out of this business.
I don't disagree with that. So the legal standards are that PG&E gets to set the standards for when these events are triggered. But that is subject to a reasonability review by the California Public Utilities Commission. So what you can do is make sure that you are communicating with the California PUC. Make sure that they bring an investigation as to whether this was reasonable in light of the operative standards. I am going to link the resolution in the show notes that was passed in 2018 after the last round of wildfire. Well, not the last round of wildfires, but after the 2017 wildfires that were so destructive. And there is a form of public accountability here. At the end of the day, right, the fact that the crumbling electrical infrastructure is in the hands of a private investor-owned company that essentially has the state over a barrel, that's a real big structural problem. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully this will provide the appropriate incentives. I can tell you every year PG&E and the other electrical company, you know, across the country, I mean, California is not unique on this, lobby and they lobby the government to reduce liability standards for electrical companies for natural disasters. And so, you know, the next time you hear Republicans talking about, you know, how this is unnecessary government red tape and we got to reduce bureaucracy, like that reducing bureaucracy means being stuck with situations
no
like
power
this
for 5 days,
where your power company can be like, well, you know, sorry,
just in case.
This is the negotiation we've entered into, that because we have you over the barrel, because there is no power company as an alternative, we're going to undertake this anticipatory measure that as you point out is going to be massively economically destructive and cause potential loss of life in your state. So there you go.
I'll try to leave it there, but like, we've got money in this state, you know, like, let's just take this POS company over and make it a state run thing. And just that way, the liabilities,
but, you know,
we have
but
it
now
anyway.
you're a flaming socialist. I mean,
I want to be a flaming socialist who has f-ing power. Sorry, Brian, you're going to have to clown horn a little bit, but like yeah, I'd rather be a socialist who has the ability to log on to the internet and stuff than, we are worried about liability. No power for 5 days. Yep. Good luck. Good luck, everybody. God, unbelievable. Hope my parents don't die. Okay, let's move on with the show. God. All right. Sorry. I've just been so mad about this for like 3 days. Because I've heard about it from my mom keeps telling me. I'm like this. And like, sorry, mom. Like, she doesn't listen. But like, when my mom tells me something, most of the time,
my
like,
mom listens to the show. You should get your mom listening to the show.
Yeah. But I mean, my mom's a Fox News viewer. So when she tells me something, usually I'm like, okay, is this real? Like, what are we talking about here? And so for a while I was like, okay, this is a conspiracy. Is Obama turning off your power? Like, what's the conspiracy theory? And then eventually it's like, oh no, this is real. This is actually happening.
Well, you know, next time, over Thanksgiving, you know, maybe suggest to mom that like government oversight of utilities is not a bad thing.
Perhaps. But, okay. Yeah. Thank you. Right. Thank you for looking into that, Andrew. I'm just confused. I did want to ask you, like, who can we sue anybody, or just because that statute or whatever it is says they can do this,
it will depend on what the PUC decides. If they decide it's unreasonable, then absolutely that will open the floodgates. If they decide that it's reasonable, that will be a defense, and they will be able to raise that in any kind of lawsuit to say, look, we were operating under color of law. We are permitted to do this. There was explicit rulemaking authority, and an independent body adjudicated that our decision prospectively to de-energize was not only authorized by statute, but appropriate given our mandate to protect the public. That's going to be their argument. So,
well, I hope that board is like not full of people who have like are lobbyists or being lobbied or whatever. I don't know who that is, but like, hopefully it's not corrupt.
I don't know the composition either, but that's another important lesson of, you know, don't dismiss public jobs. You know, when you're running for a seat on the Public Utilities Commission. Yeah, exactly. So,
oh, that's infuriating. Okay. On positive note, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our friends over at Umanum Brewing. Patrons, this is not an ad. Don't worry. This is just a shout out. Umanum Brewing. Travis over there is providing us with a delicious case or two of Umanum Brew for our Platinum event. So we're going to have that as an option. Now we're going to play.
That'll be good for me. What is everybody else going to drink?
Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to give Travis a little shout out. Everybody, yeah, no, that's friends super at cool. Can't wait to enjoy some of their tasty brews. I mean, I already have been, but I'll be honest. I tapped into the company reserves a little bit. Sorry, Andrew. I'll just give you $2. It's great stuff. We'll have it on the Platinum Night.
Who do I sue for that to get my beer back?
You can sue me. I'll make it up to you. We'll enjoy a nice tall can of So thank you very much. Just a little shout out. And now finally, let's get to the show.
Let's get to the show.
There's a little bit of news happening. A little bit of news. And we're going to, it's Trump. It's a Trump show. Every segment is Trump because it has to be. That's just how it is. So your preview for the episode is Trump.
And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.
And I love all people, rich, but in those particular positions, I just don't want a poor person. Does that make sense?
I won't go any more than that because you're Boy Scouts, so I'm not going to tell you what it is.
America's so true.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
All right, Andrew, first Trump of our Trump-isode, Trump's taxes. Oh, yeah, this was a rapid turn of events. It seemed like we were getting them, and then they were immediately seemed to be stayed by another judge. Was that all according to plan, or give us the explainer on that?
Yeah, and this, almost no media sources have gotten this correct. They have gotten, they have gotten the top line right. So, on Monday, October 7th, my birthday, the Southern District of New York handed down a comprehensive 75-page opinion written by Judge Marrero that granted the that dismissed the lawsuit brought by Donald Trump to quash the subpoena brought by District Attorney of New York Cyrus Vance against Mazars, Trump's accounting firm, seeking the production of his tax returns. So there was like an hour of, yay, we're going to get Trump's tax returns now. Yeah. That was immediately appealed to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit issued an administrative preliminary injunction blocking that rule from going into effect. So we did not get Trump's taxes on October 7th. But This does not mean that the Second Circuit ruled on the merits of the underlying dispute in any way. What they did was entered by its own terms explicitly. Here, I'll read from the Second Circuit's order. It says, appellant has filed a motion seeking an order temporarily staying enforcement of the subpoena to his accountant. Because of the unique issues raised by this appeal, and that's true, it is hereby ordered that a temporary administrative stay is granted pending expedited review by a panel of this court. A scheduling order will issue in the ordinary course. And then 2 days later, that the Second Circuit issued their scheduling order. This is as expedited as I have ever seen an appellate court. Right? Seriously, the brief, Donald Trump's brief, is due today, October 11th, by 5 p.m. So, you know, you'll be listening to this show, and then in the afternoon, as usual, there'll be a 5 p.m. news cycle dump when Donald Trump files his brief. At the same time, so is the DOJ amicus brief on behalf of Donald Trump, because we've turned the Department of Justice into Donald Trump's personal lawyer. But all of that is due today. Appellees briefs, right? So Cyrus Vance, the state district attorney's office in New York, their brief is due Tuesday, the 15th. So that's one business day they have to work on it. And then Trump's reply brief is due Thursday, the 17th, and then oral argument will be scheduled the week of October 21. So again, you know, we just did a live Q&A and someone asked, you know, how many pages per hour I can read. Like, this is part of why lawyers have to read, you know, hundreds of pages of an hour and be able to like quickly sort between cases. That is, you know, a very, very rapid turnaround, right? You got, okay, fine. You want to appeal to the Second Circuit? Great. You got 2 days to write your brief. And so, you know, that's, that does not mean, so look, it means we didn't get Trump's taxes on Monday. It does not mean that the Second Circuit in any way, is prejudging the argument, because unlike traditional injunctive relief, right, where you look at, is there irreparable harm?
That was
is
the question I was going to ask you, but you've already, pretty much answering it.
Right. They are not. It is explicitly just an administrative stay. And remember, like, we talk about staying, typically when we talk about staying the effect of an injunction pending appeal, we're talking about enjoining legislation, right? And so we're talking, the evaluation is, while it's not a full adjudication on the merits, it involves that question of, has the party seeking injunctive relief shown a substantial likelihood of success on the merits? This is much more analogous to applying the same standards that ordinarily happen when you just have two litigants, right? When you have people sue each other, and in the ordinary case, this is governed by Rule 62 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. There's a 30-day stay. Like when a court issues a ruling, there's a 30-day stay in which their judgment doesn't go into effect, and that's to give you time to appeal, right? To figure it out. Usually we don't require litigants like, okay, you lost, now I'm going to play the Jeopardy music in the background. Tell me whether you're going to appeal or not. Right? Like, no, like you get 30 days. And then at the end of the 30 days, after, you know, careful reflection, if you decide not to appeal, the order goes into effect. If you decide to appeal, then the order goes into effect unless you meet certain conditions. And one of the easiest conditions to meet is, again, the average suit when you're talking about depositing money damages, right? So you steal my beer, I sue you in federal court rules in favor of me.
Federal beer court.
And then you appeal that. You're like, oh, come on, this case was nonsense, right? I'm appealing that up to the Ninth Circuit.
The omnium was in my custody. I feel like I had a right to at least make sure it was good. Make sure it was okay.
In the case of finders versus keepers. Yeah, right. So you appeal up to the Ninth Circuit, and what the court will do is they'll say, all right, look, we'll stay the enforcement of the judgment. You don't have to pay Andrew back now, but what you do have to do is post a bond. It's called a supersedious bond. And you've got to show a beer bond, right? And you have to show that there's money to satisfy the judgment at the end of the appeal, right? Because think about that. You know, go back to our opening pre-show segment, right? PG&E, suppose they get a $10 billion damage verdict at trial, and then they're like, okay, well, we're going to appeal that. And the plaintiffs will be like, yeah, you're going to appeal it. And by the end of the appeals process, you'll have spent all the money and there won't be any money for us anymore. Mm. And so the court will be like, okay, post a bond. And if you can post a bond that will satisfy that damages result, then that will protect the plaintiff's interest.
So
and we can go ahead.
So my plan of shotgunning the entire couple cases of beer before you can get your dirty hands on it, not going to work.
Not going to work. Yeah.
All right.
So that's all going to move very, very quickly. I also have to say, Judge Marrero's order here at the Southern District is really, really good. And we have talked about in parallel cases, right, that Judge Maida's order in the D.C. in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, similarly good bulletproof opinion. This is really comprehensive, and I want to walk everyone through it because this is the merits of the argument that the Second Circuit is considering, and Trump's counter arguments are terrible. So I feel pretty good that the Second Circuit is going to affirm Judge Marrero's decision. And the way in which this case came about, this is so great. It was such a master stroke by the New York State District's Attorney's Office that we have a chance of prevailing in the Supreme Court. It creates a double bind. And I'm really, really excited to walk you through this. But it's a little bit of a difficult road to go down.
The
so
journey. All right.
Yeah. So let's take that journey together.
Deep right. dive time. Let's do
yeah.
it.
First, you have a state criminal investigation. This was referred out by a state grand jury impaneled in New York that authorizes New York District Attorney Cyrus Vance to conduct an investigation to issue subpoenas related to Donald Trump's taxes in connection with potential criminal conduct, right? That's a big deal. That's really, I mean, you know, this is already sort of going under the radar of, oh, well, this is all part of the Democrats, like, blah, blah, blah. No, this is a prosecutor convinced a grand jury in New York that there was a reasonable basis to inquire into Trump's taxes in connection with criminal conduct, right? They couldn't do that for you or I, right? Already there is substantial circumstantial evidence that, and again, we don't know what it is, right? Because grand juries are, convened, they're ex parte, and their proceedings are confidential. But they don't issue back, they don't authorize subpoenas based on nothing. So you have an ongoing state criminal investigation. And in connection with that investigation, D.A. Vance issues a subpoena to Mazars LLP, which is Donald Trump's accounting firm, and says, hey, turn over the last 8 years of your client's taxes. Then the president files this lawsuit in the Southern District of New York in federal court to get an injunction to stop Mazars from turning over his taxes. And the argument is, hey, I'm the president. I'm immune from suit. Therefore, this state proceeding is nonsense, and so you should quash the subpoena. We have covered at great length on the show that that's a dumb argument. We're going to talk about it a little bit more in the body of the opinion, but that's procedurally what happens. So step one, state criminal proceeding, state subpoena to Mazars, turn over Trump's taxes. Trump goes into federal court and says, I want an injunction. Stop this state court proceeding. Quash the injunction because I'm the president. As it turns out, there is a law that prevents people from doing exactly what Donald Trump has done. It is called the Anti-Injunction Act. It's 22 USC 2283. And it's the law is one sentence long, and it says this. A court of the United States, right, that is a federal court, may not grant an injunction to stay proceedings in state court except as expressly authorized by an act of Congress, or where necessary in aid of its jurisdiction or to protect or effectuate its judgments. Now, those last two bits are technical and not important here. But notice the broad scope of the Anti-Injunction Act. It says, yeah, we don't want people to be able to run to federal court to get injunctions to stop state courts from doing what they're doing. So unless there is a law that explicitly says you can do that, you can't do that. It's barred by the Anti-Injunction Act. So that's what ADA Vance responded. He was like, dude, Anti-Injunction Act. So then Donald Trump amended his lawsuit. And he amended his lawsuit to assert a claim under 42 USC section 1983. And you may recognize that numbered statute.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, section 1983. I know you do. So I'm going to pretend, just for the sake of our listeners who obviously don't. Right. Section 1983 claims are what you bring against the government when it violates your civil rights.
Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah. So when a cop beats the crap out of you, right, you can sue them under section 1983 for damages, right? Because they have violated your civil rights. And that's what Donald Trump said. He said, look, okay, and section 1983, by the way, is an exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. So that was then Donald Trump's response. Oh, okay, you're invoking the Anti-Injunction Act. Well, I'm arguing under section 1983 that you violated my civil rights. This is a witch hunt, and that's immune from the Anti-Injunction Act. Checkmate. Or so you'd think. But as it turns out, tough-on-crime judges have been trying to gut the effectiveness of section 1983 for as long as we've had section 1983, right? So
I think this will be another case of hoist by their own petard.
It is indeed. So the Supreme Court in 1971, and again, in fairness, 1971, pretty liberal Supreme Court, right? But nevertheless, immediately after sort of crafting the protections for defendants in the 1960s that we've talked about, in the 1970s, even the liberal Supreme Court was sort of instantly rolling back like the scope of the exclusionary rule and that sort of thing. And they issued a case called Younger versus Harris. And basically, it says this. It says, look, yes, Congress has authorized by statute the fact that a criminal defendant can sue the police force for beating the crap out of them. But what you can't do is you can't raise that 1983 claim while the underlying state court decision is pending, right? And think about the practical reasons for that immediately, right? Which is, look, yeah, we don't want evidence of how badly the cops mistreated you to come out in your actual criminal case, right? So we don't want the jury to go, okay, well, he probably did steal the car, but the cops beat the crap out of him and they shouldn't have. So therefore, we're going to find him not guilty for stealing the car.
They're trying to like separate the two proceedings so that in the jury's mind, it's like, okay, here's one thing, but then later on you can sue.
That's exactly right. And so that case, Younger v. Harris, gave rise to what we call the Younger abstention doctrine. Okay. And abstention is when a federal court that otherwise would have jurisdiction to hear a case says, you know what, we're going to abstain for a little bit, right? Not now, maybe not. We're just going to pause. And the reason
they're not throwing
for that,
it out or anything, nope. They're just not doing it yet. Okay.
Not yet. That's exactly right. And remember, that's because federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, and state courts are courts of original jurisdiction, right? You can go to a state court for anything. You go to a federal court only as specifically authorized by the Constitution and the enabling statutes, right? The Judiciary Act of 1789, and as amended, right? It's not all like these and thous. But as we've talked about on the show, the primary way in which you get to, into federal court is either you have a federal right of action under a federal statute, or you have diversity. You have parties who are citizens of different states, and the amount in controversy is at least $75,000 or more. So as a general principle, federal courts are like, if a claim could go both to federal court and to state court, maybe we should sit this one out, right? Let's let state courts do their job, and we'll come in if we have to. That's kind of the rationale behind it. Okay. Now, let me head off a little bit at the pass. Younger abstention is not like Chevron deference, right? This is not a thing that conservatives hate and gnash their teeth over and want to get rid of. This is a thing they love, right? They absolutely do not want 1983 plaintiffs in federal court to be able to get injunctions to stop state court proceedings. They want to sentence those, you know, criminal defendants and then have them try and sue localities from, you know, from jail, from prison and, you know, with the stigma of being a convicted felon and with the limited resources that come from being in prison. Right. So there is not only no compelling institutional drive by the far right to get rid of younger abstention, there is every effort made to sustain it and in fact younger abstention is so robust that it applies even when the state files its proceedings after you've initiated your federal 1983 claim. Right. So in other words, it doesn't even have to be an already, it can be part of a quote, an existing proceeding if that existing proceeding was filed after your federal proceeding, but it's live at the time that your federal proceeding is being adjudicated. And there are restrictions on that, right? Like it couldn't have, the federal proceeding must not have proceeded to any substantive resolution and some other things that don't matter. But my point on that is, younger abstention is robust, and it is particularly thought highly of by conservatives. There are three exceptions that apply to younger abstention, right? Of times where courts will say, okay, abstention is a discretionary doctrine, right? Like this
Before
is not
we
a,
get into
okay,
that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
We should probably take a break, and then I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay, well, let's take a break.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Brooklinen. Folks, you spend a third of your life in your sheets. Why not have them be insanely comfortable? Why not get the best sheets? Why not go with Brooklinen? They were named the winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. They have rave reviews from Business Insider, Apartment Therapy, from Men's Health, and they have made 500,000 sleepers happy and counting. I include myself among them. I have Brooklinen sheets. They are so comfortable. They are luxury sheets, towels, and bedding without the luxury markup. Most bedding is marked up as much as 300%, but Brooklinen was the first direct-to-consumer bedding company, meaning they work directly with manufacturers and directly with customers. No middlemen, just great product and service. Their mission is to make you comfortable. They have sheets that don't just feel great, but they look great as well. You can mix and match from over 20 plus colors and patterns to get the sheets that you want. My Brooklinen sheets are the most comfortable sheets I've slept on, and their towels have turned my bathroom into a spa. I couldn't recommend them more for friends, for family, or treating yourself to the upgrade you deserve. Go to brooklinen.com. They are giving you an exclusive offer just for our listeners. You get 10% off and free shipping when you use the promo code OA at brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, their comforters, their towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get 10% off and free shipping is to use the promo code OA at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code OA. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. So pausing on this three exceptions, you know, before this is all under the idea that his claim even makes any sense, right? Because like if we evaluate the merits of all this, it's all nonsense, right?
Correct. And I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
But I want to show sort of the brilliance of this multi-layered opinion. Gotcha. Right. So under Younger abstention, remember that abstention is not like jurisdiction. Right. If the court lacks jurisdiction, if a claim is non-justiciable or if the court lacks jurisdiction, then they can't hear the case. Mm-hmm. Right. But abstention is, we think it's a good idea not to hear this case. Right. And there are various abstention doctrines that apply. And we've talked about some in the past. So because the court has discretion, they've then fashioned some exceptions to it. Right. And they've said, look, we won't abstain under Younger if, one, we think the prosecution is in bad faith, right? And you can see, you know, liberal hippie judges immediately kind of putting that one into place, going like, oh, look, like the cops beat the crap out of this guy. And, you know, yes, the prosecutor is still prosecuting them. But we can look at it and say independently as a court, that prosecution is nonsense. It's in bad faith. And we're not going to abstain in this case. So that's kind of exception number one. Exception number two is where the prosecution is part of a pattern of harassment against an individual. And again, same thing, right? Okay, this is somebody that, you know, we see the state has taken kind of multiple swings at this guy, and we're going to recognize that as a court and go, yeah, again, this does not seem to be a legitimate or fair prosecution. And so we're not going to abstain in those kinds of instances. And then the third is sort of a catch-all, and it's phrased differently in different jurisdictions, but it is when the underlying law being enforced is completely unconstitutional, right? Where there's really no underlying basis for the ongoing state court proceedings. So these are pretty limited exceptions. And that is the basis for the first half of Judge Marrero's decision, right? He says, look, everything unfolded the way that I just described it to you. And now we have a plaintiff raising a Section 1983 claim. And there's an ongoing state prosecution, right? There was a state investigation into Donald Trump's criminal conduct. And you know what? All of these arguments that he's raising here in favor of an injunction are arguments he can raise in that proceeding. So there's no need for a federal court to come in and tell a state court what to do. Mm-hmm. We're going to abstain. It's a really, really good decision. And it's the kind of decision that you could see being affirmed by a conservative Supreme Court, right? If there were five Jared Kushners on the Supreme Court, there are probably at least two. But if there were five Jared Kushners, you could see them crafting
as I hate the Supreme Court, I think even that's a little far. I mean, Jared Kushner is an idiot who knows nothing about it.
No, that's fair. That is no good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad that Thomas is the voice of reason, curtailing me, bringing me back. That was hyperbole.
I mean, there's at least two or possibly two and a half who doesn't really matter. Like, there's no, it doesn't really matter what the case is. It's just outcome based. It seems like.
Yeah. I think that's right.
You think there's enough semi-rational and operators on this court to look at this and say, no, we can't. We'd love to help you, Mr. Trump, but can't do it.
I think that's right, because you would not want to write a wide-ranging opinion that curtailed the Younger doctrine. Now, look, you could still craft a Bush v. Gore style opinion, right? You could say, okay, well, Younger abstention doesn't apply when it's the president. You could do that.
Well, that's going to be the Negatron prediction here. I'm curious. We'll see. All right. That'll be Negatron prediction.
Fair.
Optimus Prime says they won't do that.
I think the Younger argument has a really good chance of success in the Supreme Court. But remember, I've also talked to you about how a district court judge will try to bulletproof her opinion, or in this case, his opinion. Judge Marrero does that here. So the first 35 pages are about Younger abstention. The next 40 are about the underlying argument on the merits. And it begins, again, with a candid acknowledgement. This is what bulletproofing means. Quote, Notwithstanding the court's decision to abstain, and mindful of the complexities that Younger presents, the court will proceed to examine the merits of President's claimed immunity and articulate an alternative holding so as to obviate the need for remand in the event the Second Circuit disagrees with the abstention holding. So right there out there on the table, hey, look, even if I've gotten this whole Younger stuff wrong, by the way, the underlying argument is total nonsense. And that is the same, and again, the same four-part inquiry we've always talked about on injunctive relief, the primary two levels of inquiry being one, is there irreparable harm? And two, does the party seeking the injunction have demonstrated a substantial likelihood of success on the merits? And here the court says, look, you don't have either of those, right? You specifically, and this is, I think, a really key distinction, you do not have irreparable harm in turning over your taxes to a grand jury subpoena because grand juries are confidential, right? This is not like turning it over to Congress, right? And there are pending lawsuits. I had it on the list to talk about, but we're probably not going to talk about those.
Yeah, but I had to yell about PG&E for an hour. Sorry.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
5 to 10 minutes.
It's okay. But look, this is a distinction between the public lawsuits being brought by the Congressional Oversight Committee and a lawsuit to enforce a grand jury subpoena that is confidential being brought by the state of New York's district attorney's office. So number one, there's an argument of we're not sure that this is irreparable harm, right? It's going to be carefully confined. And if they're turned over by mistake, you can shred them, right? Courts do that kind of stuff all the time. Trump's argument to the contrary here is not a bad one. I want to be as fair as I can to Donald Trump. There is an argument and there is case law that says, look, once the cat's out of the bag, the cat's out of the bag. You know, you can't cram it back in the bag. You know this cat as law. a cat lover.
Because I called 1-8-3 cat law one, whatever that was.
Yep.
I haven't seen that patron recently. Is that still there?
Yeah. I don't know. Buttercup.
Buttercup. Yeah. Maybe they have a different name now.
Maybe. Who knows? So that's not a terrible argument. But the likelihood of success on the merits, this is where Judge Marrero really shines. And he deconstructs the DOJ Office of Legal Counsel memoranda that kind of makes it sound like maybe he listened to episodes 290 and 300 of the show, right? I love this. I quoted this one out. He says, this court is not persuaded that it should accord the weight and legal force the president ascribes to the DOJ memos or accept as controlling the far-reaching proposition for which they are cited in the context of the controversy at hand. As a point of departure, the court notes that many statements of the principle that, quote, a sitting president cannot be indicted or criminally prosecuted, end of quote, typically cite to the DOJ memos as the sole authority for that proposition. Mm-hmm. Accordingly, the theory has gained a certain degree of axiomatic acceptance, and the DOJ memos, which propagated, have assumed substantive legal force as if their conclusion were inscribed on constitutional tablets etched by the Supreme Court. Love that. Yeah. Then he says, rather dryly, the court considers such popular currency for the categorical concept and its legal support as not warranted, which strikes me as a very Andrew way of putting it. So and then, like I said, after that, there's 40 pages of analysis that says this is just a sternly worded letter. Right. And the letters cite earlier letters, which cite earlier letters, which cite nothing. And yeah.
And we all know that sternly worded letters are not worth the sternly worded paper they're sternly printed on these
right.
days.
So it is, again, in my view, I could see if this were the sole basis, I would be on the negatron side at the Supreme Court. But the Younger abstention stuff is really, really good. So in any event, in just a couple of days, well, I guess in 2 weeks, we will get a ruling from the Second Circuit on this issue. They're moving ahead at breakneck pace. And, you know, we're not going to go through, but remember that the Mazars case, the parallel case involving the congressional subpoena, is still pending before the D.C. Circuit as of this morning. There was nothing new to the docket. The last pleading was filed on August the 20th. So the DC Circuit is taking its time. It could move a little more quickly for my taste, but that ruling could come out any day now. And there are multiple other proceedings and avenues, including the DC case involving the New York law requiring Donald Trump to turn over his taxes. So look, there's a lot out there. And again, I'm optimistic those inquiries are going forward. And I think there are good reasons to believe at the end of the day, you know, what I predicted back when I thought the IRS would actually comply with the law rather than with whatever the Trump White House says, which is eventually we're going to get Trump's taxes. So there you go.
All right. Wow. I'm excited. What's the soonest we're going to get these bad boys? 2027.
Look, it depends on what the Supreme Court does. And it's why I walked you through it.
What's the best case? I was trying the to best be
case,
bright side.
Right. Yeah. The best case scenario is October 22, the Second Circuit affirms Judge Marrero's order. President Trump immediately appeals to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court denies cert. That could happen.
So
then October 23rd. Yeah.
Wow.
Then Mazars. Because again, remember, Mazars, as tightly as they are tied to Donald Trump.
Yeah, they don't care. They're not.
Yeah, Mazars is. Yeah, they get a court order. They're turning those documents over. They've got them in a special folder ready to go out.
Someone should just whistleblow those. But anyway.
I agree. Two votes.
Do take whistleblowing advice from a podcast. Yeah. All right. Well, it's time for, well, how much are we going to have time for? It's time for our next Trump segment, I guess.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
So you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay. We're going to talk about Trump's... In the categories in the records that we're keeping of all the terrible arguments about impeachment, what's the latest, Mr. Torres?
Yeah, the latest argument that was concocted this week that was the subject of a truly hilariously bad letter from Pat Cipollone, who is one of Trump's personal lawyers and hacks and idiots, is the argument that. An impeachment inquiry requires a full vote on the floor of the House. We haven't had that yet, so therefore there's no real inquiry underway. I want to say, and I want to be 100% fair about this, in the cases, there is a kernel of underlying truth that has to do with respecting past outcomes, if not judicial precedent. Okay. It's hilarious thinking that this is coming from, you know, the party of Mitch McConnell. But nevertheless, I want to be as fair as possible. And that is, in both the contemplated impeachment of Richard Nixon and the actual impeachment of Bill Clinton, there was a formal vote in the House of Representatives to begin an impeachment inquiry that was a House-wide vote rather than just a committee decision. Now, two things that you need to know. A, that was not required by the Constitution or by the rules of the House of Representatives. And B, those cases are very, very factually distinguishable from the instant case. It would be similar to if the House of Representatives had decided to begin an impeachment inquiry on the basis of the Mueller report. Right. Like that would have made it more analogous to the Clinton scenario. Right. Because in each of those cases, you had wide ranging amounts of information already known. Here, you have some information that's already known, thanks to the president releasing, you know, the telcon of his call and tweeting and sending Rudy Giuliani out to confess to crimes on Fox News. But you have an investigation that actually needs to take place, right? An ever expanding investigation. And that investigation involves matters of national security. And, you know, as we've talked about, legitimate issues where you want those potentially actually sensitive matters about the U.S.-Ukraine relations and others to be disseminated to a congressional committee that can keep some of them confidential, right? So that's a really important area of distinction. The other thing that is, and I'm going to talk about the legal requirements. So the legal argument is bonkers. They're absolutely, and I just want to be 100% clear on this. The Constitution does not require that, does not mention the word impeachment inquiry. And certainly does not require that an impeachment inquiry be taken before a full vote of the House of Representatives.
Well, I want to ask, though, because mm-hmm. this is what happened when we talked about the Senate. Is there some House rule? Is there something they've passed in the past that would require this? Because the Constitution says not much about all this.
It that is an awesome, directly appropriate question. And the answer is there is a continually updated document. It is amended every time a new House of Representatives is convened, and it is called the House Practice, a guide to the rules, precedents, and procedures of the House. And it sets forth exactly how and what investigatory powers House committees have. And as it turns out, that document expressly permits the House Judiciary and oversight committees to issue subpoenas and to undertake exactly the actions that they are undertaking right now.
All right. Sounds straightforward. Case closed.
This is as case closed-y as it gets. I'm serious about this. And I want to add, in addition to that, there is also a rather lengthy report by the Congressional Research Service that describes how impeachments take place. And they note that, again, correctly so, that, yeah, let's take a public commercial break.
The dog would like to chime in with a commercial break. Here we go. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Lightstream. You know, most people carry a balance on their credit cards, and the APR on those is over 20% on average. So for every $100 that you owe on a credit card, you're paying $20 more in interest. And that's assuming your APR stays put, but variable rates can quickly soar even higher. What if you can combine all your credit card bills into one low payment, all while paying just a fraction of the average interest rate? Well, if you guessed that that rhetorical question would mean there is a way you can do it, you are right. You can. You can take control of your bills with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. You get peace of mind knowing you're saving money with an interest rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. Lightstream believes you deserve a fair, fast, and easy way to pay off your credit card balances. Get a fixed rate loan from $5,000 to $100,000. You'll pay far less in interest and nothing in fees. It's never been easier to apply online. You can even do it from your phone. And you get money in your account as soon as the same day you apply. When it comes to securing your financial freedom, you deserve a lender who cares. Lightstream has a track record of customer service that you can trust, and their credit card consolidation loan can help you pay off your credit cards, save money, and achieve your financial goals. Our listeners can get a special interest rate discount when you apply now. Just go to lightstream.com/OA. That's Lightstream, LightStream.com/OA. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes a 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit LightStream.com/OA for more information.
All right. So prior to my puppy saying, hey, let's pay some bills around here, I was describing that both the Congressional Research Service report, which I will link in the show notes, from 2015, right? Oh, 2015, that's an interesting time period. That's a Republican-controlled House of Representatives with a Democratic president. Interesting. And the sitting established House rules note that although a full impeachment inquiry typically begins with a resolution introduced, put into the hopper, and voted on by the full House of Representatives, it does not, the inquiry does not require such a resolution, that the various House committees retain power to issue subpoenas, conduct investigations, and no full authorizing resolution is required. And I want to add to that, that as part of this argument of, and again, we're going to see that an illustration that we are moving up Yodel Mountain is the continuous moving of the goalposts and the continuing desperation of the arguments on the other side. Right. So last week we dispatched with, well, the whistleblower's complaint is all nonsense because it's hearsay. This week we get to dispatch with, well, all right, well, maybe it's not hearsay. Maybe it's, but now it's not fair because you haven't had a full vote by the House of Representatives. So there's not an actual impeachment inquiry opened. And because procedural arguments are kind of dumb arguments anyway, I mean, I shouldn't say dumb arguments, right? Like sometimes procedural protections are important, that they lack the kind of salience with people, right? Like it's not to say we think this is false, right, is a substantive criticism. And yeah, you shouldn't go forward with false information against somebody. Well, now you can't really argue that this is false because the president has reaffirmed it on national television. So now you're sort of left with, well, it's procedurally unfair. And you might ask the question, well, what's unfair about it, right? And the argument that the White House is circulating and trying to get behind is, well, we need a full vote so we know exactly what it is that you're investigating so that we can call our own witnesses and cross-examine them and confront them and have due process. That argument is false. That argument is based on an
episode of CSI or episode of Law and Order Special Victims Unit. That's not this is not a court thingy. This is an impeachment proceeding, right? It's not, you don't get all the, you know, the same rules and the same rights that you have in a court of law. Is that correct?
And that is correct. That is clear. That is 100% clear as a matter of law. And to the extent that there is an analogy to be made, the appropriate analogy in this case is to a grand jury proceeding. Right. And as we know, right, because that's all an impeachment inquiry is, right? An impeachment inquiry is gathering information to make a recommendation about whether the president should be charged with committing high crimes and misdemeanors. That's it. And when the state gathers information about Thomas Smith to decide whether you should be charged with a crime, they don't have to tell you.
Yeah, they don't have to release every step of the way during the investigation. Hey, Thomas, is this okay? Let's run this by you if we interview these witnesses. Do you want to be here for that? No, they wouldn't do any of that. It's nonsense.
Yep. And again, I'm going to include, these are the most recent House rules. It is page 324, and I don't want people to just accept my conclusory analysis of it. I want to read you what the rules say. The rules say, the House has always examined the charges by its own committee before it has voted to impeach. This committee has sometimes been a select committee, sometimes a standing committee. In some instances, the committee has made its inquiry ex parte. But in the latter practice, the sentiment of the committee has been in favor of permitting the accused to explain, present witnesses, cross-examine, and be represented by counsel. Okay. So if you want to argue that the House should treat you in a particular way, you may make that argument and we can debate it in public. But when Donald Trump and when his clown horn of a lawyer, Pat Cipollone, says this is an unconstitutional proceeding and we're not complying with it, he is flat out lying about the law. There is no provision in the Constitution that requires it. And I just read you the provision in the House rules that says, yeah, look, the committee can be a select committee. It can be a standing committee. It can do it on its own. There is no requirement that they submit to a vote, and there's no requirement they listen to you at all. If Donald Trump were cooperating with the committee in the same way that Bill Clinton cooperated with the committee, then I would be totally in favor of establishing as much due process as possible. But the idea that this is a basis for ordering White House staff to refuse to comply with subpoenas, that's where the next battleground of this is going to go. And you need to know, our listeners need to know, everybody needs to know, that argument is not a legal argument. That argument is, I don't want the House to impeach Donald Trump. And fine, you can have that view if you want, but let's not pretend that this is an illegal inquiry. It is not.
Case closed.
Case closed.
All right. All right. Well, we are out of time, but you know what? I think we can talk about the Open Skies Treaty, which is something you wanted to do a little medium dive on. I think that'll be a good live show topic. So speaking of, there's just about a minute. It's like a day. This is the last minute. And there are just a couple tickets left. If you want to come see us in LA. Oh, you know, there's something else that I'm going to tease just for fun. Brian and I had an idea. And Brian, of course, is the executor of most of my ideas. I had an idea for a very extra special opening arguments intro to be played at the live show that you are going to not want to miss. It is going to be so funny. And I think we'll make it available for patrons, too, of course. I mean, not everybody can be there. In fact, very few of you can actually be at the show. So we'll make sure the patrons hear it, too. But that's a good reason to be a live show attendee or a patron. Brian made it, and we've both been laughing at it ever since.
I haven't heard it, so I would be surprised.
I like to keep things from Andrew so he enjoys them in the moment. So make sure that you pay attention when that music kicks in at the live show. So couple tickets left, and we will do this medium dive on the Open Skies Treaty, on Saturday at the Hudson. Can't wait.
Awesome.
Hope to see you there very soon. All right. That said, you know what time it is, Andrew? It's time to thank our new patrons for First Timer Friday. And, as we said last week, we're doing this in batches until we catch up. So if you're a new patron, you might not get read today, but you rest assured everybody will get their name read so long as they are still a patron by the time the show happens. So there we go. Why don't I start us off? And why don't I start us off? So thank you to the new patrons over at patreon.com/law. I hope they enjoyed the Q&A, all the good stuff. A lot of awful movies coming at you pretty soon. Here we go. James Michael Grunwald, Ruth Kanky, I'm not sure, sorry. Howard Jackson, Robert Coleman, Kyle, Stephen Adams, Jordan Fisher, to shreds, you say. It's kind of funny. Richard
to shreds, you say.
Is that?
That's a Farnsworth, quote? Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. Richard Still, it was in my mind somewhere, but I couldn't place it. PF, Jeremy Shoup, Max, which I just have to say, that's how Phoebe pronounces suit. So when she has her swimsuit, she says, my swim shoop. And it's so funny. Anyway,
me too. Jeremy Shoup.
Max Baxter, Damian Bossy, Mike Lewis, Mason Miller, President Pelosi by Christmas. Yeah, well, if the air show goes wrong between Air Force One and Two, as we talked about. Danielle, Zachary Robinson, Keith Vertrees, Christopher Ross, artofhedging.com. I don't know if that's real, but it's interesting. Amy Eason, newly optimistic bureaucrat. Jamie, Bigglesby Harpsichord, service has been restored. Limbo Lakumi like me. Wow. Brandon Willis, Burz Molly, I am a hollerback girl. Mark Kiba, Keith Billick, Sean Bennett, Daniel Heaton, Andy Miller, Fuzzy, two votes for a live show in Austin. That's not impossible. I will say that's not impossible. There are some towns and places that it is impossible. Austin, that's possible. I'm going to go ahead and say. Christopher Kelly, Andrew, David Blakely, Tom Faulkner, Stacy Kelch, Peggy Sage, Mike Mrock, Matt Salazar, Oklahoma listener who thinks Seattle deserves an Joey Live Show. That's funny. Everybody's coming out for Seattle. They all want that show. We'll make it happen then. Buddy Atkins, Yodeling is Love, Yodeling is Life. Randall Nelson Peterman, Quinn Blankenheim, Luke Thomas, Dew 209, Grant Gleiner. You had me at Articles of Impeachment. Just John, Jeffrey Cook, Jocko Martilla, Howler Monkey Reputation Restoration Foundation. Yeah. Jennifer Harb, does Trump have any cabinet left? Actually, I don't know. I'm not even sure. Donnie, JBE is the best governor of Louisiana. I joined Patreon and Thomas gave my state to Canada. Sorry. Randall Ball, Mitch Tibbs, burrito champion. A. Dix, Leonard Nimoy's head. Oh, there you go. Another, I think that's Futurama reference, most likely. Connor Ard, Nate Green, Michael Lorne, Alexis Sutliff, America Sucks Balls, LOL. All right, sure. David Smith, Carolyn Stein, Jonathan Trask, and Matthew Ramsey. There we go. Your turn, Andrew.
All right, and thank you to DW, to Anon, to Andrew is my favorite precious snowflake, Thomas is a close second, ooh. Adam Was, Kyle Hall, Mara Frank, Eric Rottinghouse, Tim, Susan Geisler, Ryan B., Jared, Bill Garrisey, Leah Monkey, support your local library for information access. Yeah, that's a great idea. Simon McNabb, Murray Clark, Manny Ignazio, Vivian Imbriatis, William Gallagher, Dan Hansen, I'll give you more when I get a job. Oh, well, hey, look, like, as we always say, you know, if you got to take care of yourself, your family, we understand. Hit us up when you're, you know, hit us up when you get a job. Insane in the Ukraine. Greg Botchker, wine drunk for butt stuff is back. All right. Electric Monk. Yeah, do my believing for me. Chad Swelland, Tommy Collins, Anonymous, C-Money. Yeah. Oh. Michael Rowley, Laurie Pycroft. I became a patron just to say Seattle Live Show, Seattle Live Show. Well,
jeez.
Yeah, we
pretty much got the seats full at this point.
Yep. Dancing to the tune of Nancy Pelosi announcing an impeachment inquiry. Edward Mason, Brendan Hanrahan, Mike DeMonte, Guy Stewart, Molly Anstoder, Wyatt Vine, Jason Pugh, Craig Hester, the Quiznos Demon. Oh, boy, I missed that. That was kind of a little like possessed, like hamster kind of thing. Adam Larson, Atom, A-T-O-M, Larson. April's last name sounds just like Yudi, I think. I don't know. There's some unpronounceable characters in there. Thomas Go. Jonathan Ploucha, after 3 years, you finally got me. Well, I'm glad. Alex Davis, Keith Wisnanis, Yodeling from New Zealand, Kia Ora, Christopher W., Mike S., Whack, Craig Harlow, Richard Reed, Richard Goldsmith, Andrew Fillmore, Tim Shoemaker, Eric Casey, Jamila Mahan, Kristen Daniel, DJ Diabetes. Oh, that's a fantastic house name. David Spack, Jay Bickford, There Is No God But Godzilla, and Mothra Is His Prophet, Josh Greenberg, Sean Meadows, Michael Rosofsky, Ben Sedano, Kathy Salinko, take that, Janice, no longer a free rider, J.O., Red State Science Teacher, help me, Dennis Smith, and J. Artist. So that's the letters J. Artist. So that was fairly clever. So thanks to all of you for signing up over patreon.com/law. Hopefully you're enjoying the multiple bonus deep dive episodes, the Q&A, all the great stuff. Yeah, look, we don't have to sell. You're already patrons. So spread the word about how great it is to be a patron, because it's pretty damn great.
Yeah, hell ass, yeah. All right, it's time for T3BE. I was on a streak, and then I ran into a buzzsaw that was that last question. That was a tough one.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
I was going to say, the bar exam is going to give you a chance for a little bit of a do-over on that question. These are the same facts repeated again for a follow-up question. Okay? To remind you, bright 12-year-old child attended a daycare center after school. Center was located near a man-made duck pond on the property of a corporation. During the winter, pond was used for ice skating when conditions were suitable. At a time when the pond was obviously only partially frozen, the child sneaked away from the center's property, walked out over the ice onto the ice over the pond. The ice gave way. Child fell in, suffered shock, would have drowned if he had not been rescued. At the time of the incident, the pond was clearly marked by numerous signs that said, "Thin ice, keep off." When the child sneaked away from the daycare center, the center was staffed with a reasonable number of qualified employees, and the employees were exercising reasonable care to exercise the children to ensure that the children in their charge did not leave the premises. There had not been a previous instance of a child coming onto the corporation's property from the daycare center. The jurisdiction follows a rule of pure comparative negligence. So that's the facts. The question: in a suit brought on the child's behalf against the daycare center and based only on the facts above, who is likely to prevail? A, the child, because he left the center while he was under the center's care. B, the child, because the daycare center is located near a pond. C, the daycare center, because it was not negligent. Or D, the daycare center, because the child was a trespasser.
Here I was in my infinite integrity thinking, you know, is it fair that I would get to answer another question on these facts after hearing the answer to the last one? I was already questioning myself like that. That seems unfair. And yet I'm more confused, not less confused. So, I mean, maybe there's an advantage to hearing the last answer first, like rather than having to take the whole test at once, you know, not knowing the answer to either of them. But I don't, it's not helping me with this. So I don't know. We'll see. Okay. Well, in the last question, a bright 12-year-old child should have known better, but that was when we were looking at whether or not the 12-year-old child could sue the corporation that had, you know, put the sign up that said thin ice, keep off, all that stuff. You're on thin ice, buddy, is what it said, I think. But this is different. This is the child, a suit on the child's behalf. So maybe the parents or somebody are suing the daycare center saying, hey, I put my weirdly old child for daycare in your daycare center, and they snuck out and almost died in some cold water. So what do we think? Okay, A, child, because he left the daycare, left the center while he was under the center's care. Now that sounds like the pure, like, are you negligent or not? Or not negligent, are you liable? That sounds like, are you liable or not? And that's one of those answers where it's like, all right, we can negotiate beyond that, but the child was under your care, this happened, you are liable, and then we go from there, kind of thing. I think I've heard you talk about in the past. I don't know if that applies here when it says jurisdiction follows a rule of pure comparative negligence. So I don't know. Did you see why I'm more confused? I have no idea. B, the child, because the daycare center is located near a pond. Located near pond. If that's it, I quit, because that's a stupid answer. Come on. Because it's located near a pond. So it doesn't matter any of the other facts. Like, it doesn't matter how, if it was like triple gated armed guards around the pond. Just the fact that it's near a pond. Okay. If it's B, I'm quitting the law and I'm officially not going to become a lawyer. So I'm limiting B. C, the daycare center, because it was not negligent. That is a strong contender, because the fact pattern seems to be that they weren't negligent. I mean, they did everything they could. They had a reasonable number of employees. There's never been another instance of a child sneaking out like that. So that seems like a good answer. So C is a contender. D, the daycare center, because the child was a trespasser. That's interesting. Interesting. I don't think that's it, but I'm trying to think of how that could be it. You know, like, so the difference would be like if the child snuck out and just fell into a manhole, you know, like on the street, that would be one thing. But since they trespassed and they kind of did something wrong, since the child did something wrong, Well, actually, that could be, because when you talk about the jurisdiction follows a rule of pure comparative negligence, is there some level, now I don't know if negligence would be the right word, but is there some level of liability that the child has because the child trespassed? And we are established in the previous question that this bright 12-year-old child should have known better. Ooh, so I'm going from A or C and D. I'm trying to eliminate another one. The child's because he left the center while he's under the center's care. That's kind of just the basic. I don't know that A letter A answer A is it, but I also, it's not like a firm elimination for me. It seems like a logical answer. So if the daycare center prevailed, would it be because they were not negligent, or would it be because the child, because of what the child did subsequent to leaving the daycare center and whether or not that was trespassing? That's hard. This is really hard because I could see like a scenario where even if the daycare center was a little negligent and the child snuck out and then the child, you know, like tries to kill somebody and gets injured in the process of committing some sort of crime, like should the daycare center really be responsible given that the child was doing something wrong? I don't know. All right. This is a really hard one. I don't know. I'm going to go ahead and say, I'm going to try to keep it simple and might not pay off this time, but in general, you know, hopefully the odds pay off. I'm going to say C, the daycare center, because it was not negligent. Look, it was doing what it should be doing. And I, you know, if the child sneaks out and gets into some trouble, I don't know. I'm not confident in this. I think it could be D. I think it also could be A. This is just really hard. And knowing the answer to the previous question did not in any way help me. So I'm going with C, final answer.
All right. Well, and if knowing the answer to the previous question didn't help you either, feel free to play along. You know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your answer, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to our patrons. And we will see you for the live show in a day or two. Can't wait to see you all there. Every single one of you. Are all going to fit somehow and get over there. All right, we'll see you then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission. Brian, forget all this, and I'm an idiot. All right.